So the passage that we're considering this morning is that one we read from Romans chapter 3 and verses 9 to 19. And it's been a few weeks since we were in the book of Romans. And I just thought then I'd just very quickly, briefly remind you what the Apostle Paul has been saying to us throughout these previous chapters that we've been looking at. And just to very briefly remind you then, Paul is preparing here to tell us about what he calls the gospel. The gospel, that is an incredible message, the announcement of news that is both wonderful and world-changing. Paul has been set apart for the preaching of that news, and he's rearing up, he's getting ready to give it to us in all of its glory. But before he can do that, before he can give us the good news, he has to first tell us the bad news. He has to tell us news that stings. And the bad news is simply this, that all mankind is under sin. And that includes not just those dirty Gentiles out there, but it also includes those people who consider themselves to be righteous. It also concerns those people who consider themselves to be enlightened. It involves those people, those Jews, in fact, who had access to God's law when those Gentiles out there didn't. All of those people, even those people which God had privileged in many, many ways, were under sin. And now, in today's passage, then, Paul is just for one last time sort of underscoring and reiterating this gloomy fact. Verse 9, what then, are we Jews any better off? No, not at all. For we have already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, are under sin. Now, personally, I am very keen to get ahead. We're now within touching distance of Paul's gospel. It's there in verse 21, sort of beckoning us to come right at it. We need this good news that he's preparing us for, but not right yet. No, if we're really going to enjoy this good news, we need to first understand this bad news. All mankind is under sin. And just in case we don't understand yet how bad that is, let me point out to you through this passage three things that Paul has to say to us. So firstly, being under sin is an extreme problem. It's an extreme problem. So look from verse 10 to verse 18, and you'll see there that Paul gives us this big long list, or what looks at first like a big long quotation from the Old Testament. And it looks like that at first, it looks like a single quotation, but actually it is a big long list of different quotations. It's a collection of quotations taken from different places in the Old Testament. And in my first two points this morning, I want us to think about what Paul is doing with these different quotations. And right now, I just want to try and show you this. Paul is selecting quotations here which highlight the extremity, the extremeness of sin. He's not just quoting from anywhere in the Old Testament which mentions sin. No, he's specifically quoting from those places where we can see sin in the extreme, where we can see that being under sin really is an extreme problem. Let me try to set this out for you this morning. So notice to begin with that most of Paul's quotations are taken from the Psalms. And probably without exception, all the Psalms he's quoting from are Psalms of David. So let me just spell this out. Verses 10 to 12 are a quotation from Psalm 14 and Psalm 53. Both of those Psalms are Psalms of David. Then verse 13 includes two quotations, one from Psalm 5, which is a Psalm of David, and another from Psalm 40, which is also a Psalm of David. Then verse 14, we have this quote from Psalm 10, which is very probably a Psalm of David. And then in verse 18, he quotes from Psalm 36, which is also a Psalm of David. And the remaining verses in there, which I didn't mention, are from Proverbs and Isaiah, and we'll come back to those in a second. Now, apart from being written by David, what do all of those psalm quotations have in common? Well, this is what they have in common. They're all psalms, they're all from psalms in which David, as the Lord's anointed, is being pursued by his enemies. The book of Psalms is divided into five books, and most of the quotations in this list come from book one of the Psalms. And when you read through book one of the Psalms, there's an unmissable theme, which is the theme of the Lord's anointed, the Lord's chosen king, the Lord's Messiah, being hunted down and pursued and threatened and falsely accused by his enemies. These are the Psalms which Paul is quoting from. And in fact, even when Paul quotes from Psalms which are outside of book one, he's still quoting from Psalms which have that same theme. So the words that Paul quotes are words of the psalmist directed at his enemies, the king's enemies, the Messiah's enemies, ultimately the Lord's enemies. They are from Psalms where the Lord's Messiah is crying out for help, that the Lord would deliver him and rescue him from these false allegations and these enemies which are trying to kill him. And I think Paul's point is simply this, that being under sin means being an enemy of the Lord and his Christ and his Messiah. It means belonging to that class of people who are baying for the blood of the Lord's Messiah. That's why I'm calling it an extreme problem. There's a dividing line in those Psalms. There is the one single righteous man, and then there is everybody else who is against him. And Paul is saying, you are not in this one category. When you're under sin, you're in this other category, this great mass of enemies which are trying to get at the Lord's Messiah and are raging against their God. So it's an extreme problem for that reason. But then I think there's more to this than that. I think actually Paul is saying more. He's saying that being under sin doesn't just mean being an enemy of the Lord and his Messiah. I think Paul is also suggesting here that it means being a child of the devil. Let me try to show you where I'm seeing this then in these quotations. So just notice how Paul draws our attention to two specific areas of sin. So initially, he's talking about sort of the rejection of God generally in verses 11 and 12. But then from verse 13 onwards, it gets a bit more practical. It's sin affecting the behavior. And Paul draws our attention to two specific areas of sin affecting our behavior. And the first one is deception, and the second one is violence. So deception, then, we're seeing it in verses 13 and 14. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. It's sins of the tongue. It's deceptiveness. It's lying. And then violence. Verses 15 to 17, feet which are swift to shed blood, in their paths ruin and misery, the way of peace they have not known. So Paul is saying here that all mankind is fundamentally deceptive and all mankind is fundamentally violent. That's what Paul's saying. Now, where else in the scriptures do we see deception and violence going hand in hand? Well, remember Jesus' words speaking to the Jews in John chapter 8 and verse 44. Listen to what he says. He says to them this: "You are of your father, the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires." And so we ask ourselves, what are the devil's desires? Jesus goes on, "He was a murderer from the beginning," that's violence, "and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him," that's deception. "When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and the father of lies." And Jesus is drawing attention to those two aspects because the Jews that he's speaking to there are plotting to kill him. And they're also twisting his words and they're lying about him. And Jesus sees that and he recognizes those two fundamental aspects of the devil. He was always a murderer. We talked on Good Friday, didn't we, about how the devil has always been violently opposed to the Lord's anointed throughout history. And he was always a liar from the very first day when he lied to Eve in the garden. And so for that reason then, Jesus calls these people children of the devil. They're born murderers, born liars. And you might think, well, that just applies to that very narrow class of people who were opposing Jesus on that occasion there in the Gospel of John. But actually, no, I think Paul is telling us, well, no, these are the fundamental themes of human nature. These are the impulses which lie at the bottom of our nature, and those impulses are devilish. It's because we're children of the devil. It makes sense, doesn't it, of his reference to snakes, I think, there. He talks in verse 13 about the deceptiveness of speech being compared to the venom of asps, of snakes. You know, the devil's compared to snakes throughout Scripture. Or even when we get to this issue of violence in verses 15 to 17, those quotations are taken from Isaiah chapter 59. And if you go back to that chapter, if you go back to Isaiah 59 and you look at the passage that Paul is quoting from, you'll see there that these violent people are described as laying adder's eggs and hatching vipers. Now, Paul doesn't quote from that bit of the text, but I think it's possibly there under the surface. So it maybe takes a little bit of reading through the lines here, but I think the suggestion is quite clear that being under sin means being opposed to the Lord's anointed, it means being an enemy of God, it means going after his Messiah, and it means ultimately being a child of the devil. It's an extreme problem. It's an extreme problem. And I suppose then at this point in my sermon, I'll just say this, and it's not something that I relish saying, but however unpopular it may be today, we do need to adopt Paul's extreme view of sin. We recently had a Jewish man, a Christian Jewish man who came to our church in Newcastle. And he was talking about reaching out to the Jews with the gospel. And he said that one of the biggest obstacles he faces is that many of the people he's speaking to have a very low view of sin. You know, for many Jews today, sinning is really just about sort of breaking the law in this place or that place, breaking God's law a little bit here and a little bit there. And I think Paul would have encountered exactly the same misunderstanding in his own day, the same low view of sin, a failure to understand that sin is not simply an occasional mistake that we make here and there. No, sin rules us. As he says in verse 9, Jews and Gentiles in their natural condition are under sin. It defines our life and our allegiances and our direction and our basic stance as human beings. And I just want you then this morning to grasp the significance of this, because you might be tempted to think of sin as something which just kind of creeps around the edges of human life. That human beings are basically good, but sin has compromised us and stained us a little bit, and it leaves us with blemishes on our character here and there. But that's not what Paul's saying. Paul's saying that human beings in their natural state are under sin. They belong to an entirely different camp. They are enemies of God. They are enemies of his king, enemies of his Messiah, and they are friends, no, indeed, the children of the devil. They belong to his team, his camp, his order. In verse 15, Paul quotes from Proverbs 1. And again, in Proverbs chapter 1, sin is presented to us as a whole order of life. It's the way of sinners. And so being a sinner means being under sin. And I don't want us to underestimate this or reduce this or minimize this. In our natural state as human beings, we are enemies of God and children of the devil. So it's an extreme problem. But then secondly, being under sin is a universal problem. It's a universal problem. In the last few chapters, Paul has been arguing that both Jews and Gentiles, at the end of the day, are in the same camp. They're in the same category. They're both sinners. And in this passage, Paul is really just making sure that that point has not been missed. Sin is a universal problem. And that's why I think he quotes from those very universal lines in verse 10 of the psalm. No one is righteous, no, not one, no one understands, no one seeks for God, all have turned aside. He's trying to make this category as expansive as possible. Now, you might read that and think, well, isn't that sort of playing around a little bit with what David was doing in his psalm? I mean, were those words really supposed to be taken literally? I mean, for one thing, the as we've already said, it's the psalmist, the Lord's anointed in the psalm, is in Israel, and he's looking at his immediate circumstances, and really what he's saying there is, all of my fellow Israelites are out there to get me. So he's just really talking about his enemies within Israel, isn't he? It's just a kind of an exaggerated, hyperbolic way of talking. Well, actually, no, I don't think so. I think these words might have been, in the first instance, directed mainly at Israelites, but not only at Israelites. I said earlier that the book of Psalms is divided into five books, and those five books seem to have differences between them. And one of the differences between book one of the Psalms and book two of the Psalms is that book one of the Psalms seems to be written in that Israelite context, David's being pursued by his enemies within Israel. Book two, on the other hand, seems to be mainly addressed at the surrounding nations. And I'm bringing up that distinction for this reason. In verses 10 and 12, or 10, 11 to 12, Paul is actually quoting from two Psalms at the same time. He's quoting from Psalm 14, and he's quoting from Psalm 53. And that's because those two psalms are basically identical. He could be quoting from either in this case. Both of those psalms are about the fool who says in his heart, there is no God. You recognize those words. They're from both of those psalms. They both start in that way. Those psalms are written about those who reject God. They speak about people we could describe as practical atheists. But here's the difference. Psalm 14 is from book 1, whereas Psalm 53 is from book 2. Arguably, I think Psalm 14 is addressed at those Israelite enemies, but as for Psalm 53, it's as if that psalm takes precisely the same words, but now addresses them to a more universal context, to the Gentile enemies in the world around. I won't get too sort of lost in the details of this, but it's interesting actually that in book one of the Psalms, God is usually referred to as the Lord, or as Yahweh. That's the special name which was given to the Jews. In book two of the Psalms, you have that more general name for God, Elohim, just God, which is a familiar name with the surrounding nations, that name is used predominantly, and Yahweh is used very little. And probably that is because Book 1 is addressed to that Jewish context, and Book 2 is aimed at the Gentiles. And that's one of the differences, actually, between Psalm 14 and Psalm 53. They're almost identical, but at one point, Psalm 14 refers to God as the Lord, and at that very same moment, Psalm 53 decides to change the word to God, the more universal word. And so I think this might be a very long way of expressing this to you this morning, but the psalm is I think, so universally applicable, it makes its way into the psalm book twice, once to address specifically the Israelites and once to address the surrounding nations. And Paul is quoting from that very psalm, which kind of covers everybody. And so practical atheism, a refusal to seek God and understand God and a failure to do what's good, that is a problem that Paul thinks spans the entire globe. It's a universal problem. I'll just make one final point to expand what I'm saying here. Look what Paul says in verse 19. He says, "Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God," or better translated, may be guilty before God. I think that verse is a little bit tricky, but let me just try to explain what I think it's saying. So Paul is saying that these scriptures, what he calls the law, is addressed to the Jews. We know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law. The Jews are under the law. So the scriptures are addressed to the Jews specifically. And so he's saying then these scriptures speak to and condemn the very people who call them their own. A Jew might say, well, I'm so special because I live under God's law. I have the Psalms and the Proverbs to teach me. But Paul's point is, well, then the Psalms and the Proverbs are talking about you in particular. You are under sin. But then he goes on to say, so that every mouth may be stopped. And I think Paul's point is this, that if the scriptures condemn those privileged Jews who are so keen to obey them in many respects, then surely that means there is no hope for us Gentiles who lie outside of that group of people. The whole world is clearly guilty with them. If they're guilty, then certainly we're guilty. Every mouth is stopped. And so there's that Pharisee in Luke chapter 18. And he goes to the temple and he prays, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. And Paul says God's law, God's word goes in there and it closes that mouth and it says, be silent, face the facts. You too are an enemy of God. You too are under sin. And there's that rich young ruler, and he says, look, from my youth I haven't murdered or committed adultery or stolen or bore false witness or defrauded or dishonored my parents. And God's law comes right into that situation, and it says, face the facts. For all your good works, at heart you remain an enemy of God. You are under sin. And if God's law, God's word, closes those Jewish mouths, then surely it will go about this whole wide, wide world, stopping every mouth. And you might stand there and you might raise all sorts of arguments and bring about all sorts of evidence for your goodness, all these great acts of obedience you've performed in your life, all of these things that you think can make your case. And Paul is saying, they're not good enough. And the best thing that you can do in the presence of these scriptures is to close your mouth. Because the default position of this whole wide world, Greeks and Jews together, is that we're under sin. Sin is a universal problem. So that's my first two points. Sin is an extreme problem, Sin is a universal problem. But then thirdly and finally, sin is, or being under sin, is an impossible problem. An impossible problem, by which I mean it's impossible for us to solve. You know that feeling that you get when someone senior to you, maybe a teacher at school, criticizes something that you've done in the classroom, and it stings a little bit. And there's part of you in that moment which just wants to sort of skip over the criticism and get to the point where you're able to say, look, okay, I'm sorry, I'll try to do better next time. Well, perhaps for some people, reading Paul is a bit like that. You just want to get to that point where you can say, fine, Paul, fine, I get it. We've made some serious mistakes, Jews and Gentiles, all of us. We've all hated our God. We've all followed the devil. I get your message by now. You don't need to go any further. I'll try to do better next time. But you see, that is not what Paul wants you to say. What Paul wants you to say at this point in the argument is, I can't do better next time. I am unable to do better next time. It is impossible for me to do better next time. The Bible teaches that there is a depth to sin, so deep that human effort can't uproot it, can't deal with it, can't solve it. Paul quotes there in verse 18 from Psalm 36, verse 1. He quotes from the end of that verse, there is no fear of God before their eyes. But actually the full verse is like this. Psalm 36, verse 1, transgression speaks or whispers to the wicked deep in his heart. There is no fear of God before his eyes. It's a verse that speaks not just of the extremity of sin, but the depth of sin. Transgression speaks deep in his heart. Its effects are too deep, too total for him to remedy. It's easier for a dead man to wake himself up than it is for a sinner to rid himself of his sin. To do that is impossible. And so Paul wants us to see at this point that human beings have what I'm calling an impossible problem. A problem that human effort and human skill and human brain power can't resolve. Because as Paul says at the end of this passage in verse 20, for by the works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight. When Paul refers to works of the law there, it's a bit of a thorny issue, which we'll come back to later on in future sermons. But really, I think he simply means any attempt on our part to be righteous before God, any attempt to obey God's law, that's what works of the law are. Any attempt to serve him better, to work harder. And Paul is saying, look, I'm sorry, but that's not good enough. For by the works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight. Doing that won't justify you. It won't make you righteous before God because your problem is far, far, far too deep. You can't justify yourself through the law, through those good works. It's impossible. Your problem is impossible for you to solve. And that's how we need to react then when we read through Paul's argument. Not to say, look, I'll try better next time, but to say, woe is me, because I can't. I'm stuck now. I've dug myself into a hole which is too deep for me to get out of. Woe is me. And then there's an additional problem. An additional problem which Paul points out at the end. He says in verse 20, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. Since through the law comes knowledge of sin. What does he mean by that? What does he mean by knowledge of sin coming through the law? Well, he might be saying that the law of God exposes our sin. You know, the more that we understand God's law, it sort of switches on the lights and we see how sinful we really are. But I think there's more to it than that, actually. Because when the Bible talks about knowledge of something or someone, it doesn't just mean knowing about it. It usually means knowing something in a more intimate and more involved kind of way. So I think Paul is not just saying that the law teaches us about sin. No, he's saying that actually, through the law, we learn to sin. Now, what does he mean by that? How does the law lead us to sin? Well, listen to what Paul says later on in the book of Romans. Romans chapter 7, verse 7. He says, "For I would not have known what it is to covet if the law had not said, 'You shall not covet.' But sin, seizing an opportunity through the commandment, produced in me all kinds of covetousness." So do you get the idea? Here's the law of God, right? And the law of God is good and it's holy. And it says, you know, whatever you do, don't disobey God, don't do that thing. But you see, here we are, and we're born sinners. As the psalm says, transgression speaks to us deep in our hearts. It whispers to us in our hearts. And because of this law which has arrived on the scene, suddenly ideas that we never had before the law arrived now pop into our heads. And suddenly that thing, that wicked thing we were told not to do, becomes very enticing, very alluring, like a forbidden fruit. And we reach out and we actually find ourselves doing that very thing that we were told not to. So through the law, we learn not just about sin, we learn actually to sin. Because sin in us seizes the opportunity and grabs the thing that we're not supposed to have. Paul says in Romans 7, "The very commandment that promised life proved to be death to me." And as he says here, through the law comes knowledge of sin. So I hope you get the picture here. Paul is really trying to make this point very clear for us. We're in an impossible problem. Sin is deep. We can't justify ourselves before God. We are unable to do that. And you might think to yourself, well, what we need then is a big list of do's and don'ts to tell us how to live. What we need is a law to follow. That will make us better. But no, Paul says, because even when that law of God arrives on the scene, we are so bad that we seize the good law, take advantage of it, and use it as an opportunity to sin the more. So being under sin is an impossible problem. And so this is where we find ourselves at the end of this passage. Paul is just leaving us here, totally devastated, speechless, and in a helpless condition. Mankind is under sin. It's an extreme problem. It's an impossible problem. It's a universal problem. We can't solve it. So what do we do now? Where do we go from here? Well, next week things will change and we look forward to that happening. But until next week, let's just remember this. Paul is not telling us this to upset us, fundamentally. He's telling us this for our own good. Because if we don't understand how bad our problem is, then we won't understand how good our gospel is. You know, some people think that the kind of Christians who believe this stuff really must be completely miserable. But, you know, that's not true. You know, the Christians who really believe this stuff must be the most joyful Christians on the planet. Because the more we believe Romans chapter 1 to chapter 3 verse 20, the happier we should be. For this simple reason, that the book of Romans doesn't end at chapter 3 verse 20. It goes on for another 13 chapters. And throughout those chapters, Paul is going to give us God's happy remedy to our impossible problem. Please realize this. You really are in a helpless condition without the gospel. But the Christian who understands just how helpless we are will see far more beauty in the face of Jesus Christ than anybody else. He will see far more glory in his cross. She will see far more promise in his resurrection, far more peace and power in his words than anybody else, because she understands, or he understands, just how helpless a condition they've been in. And so this is why Paul is spending so long setting the scene. He's like an expert gardener. And we come along to Paul and we say, "What do you think of our garden, Paul?" And really it's just a big failure. It's full of weeds and it's full of litter. And we say, "Well, it's not that bad. Look at that, look at that, look at that. It's quite good, isn't it?" But Paul wants to give us something far, far, far better than that. And so he spends all of this time tearing it up and pulling out the weeds. And all of those things that we thought were perhaps okay, he throws them into a big skip. And now the ground lies empty and bare, and we're wondering, really, was it all that bad? We're in a very gloomy condition. But you see, Paul the gardener has his purposes. And now he's ready to plant a garden which is so glorious we will hardly believe our eyes. And that's what we look forward to in the next few weeks as we consider this epistle. We're going to see our gospel shining brightly against this gloomy backdrop. And so, yes, today we have seen the bad news, and we've recoiled a bit from it. But let's embrace it, because the more we embrace just how helpless we were without Christ, the more we will see the loveliness and the grace of God in the gospel of Jesus Christ. Amen.